session is being recorded, so please turn off or silence your cell phones and hold all of your questions until after the presentation's over. With that, I'll welcome Matt Simon to introduce our speaker.
Thanks, William. Thanks for coming. It's my honor to introduce Dr. Mary Barbacek from Penn State University. Mary is a professor of entomology at Penn State with background in environmental biology and pest management. Mary conducts research on biological soil quality and sustainability and the ecology of entomopathic.
Yeah, that's close enough. Nematodes.
Nematodes right. And fungi. Mary's also a board member of the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. It's our great honor to present to you Mary Barbacek.
Thanks. And thank you so much for inviting me. It's been so wonderful. So wonderful to see everything that's going on around the country, really. And it's exciting that so many students are here and with the poster session to see everything that's going on. And so with that, I'm going to talk about some concepts and practices. And what was really great, you probably all were on the farm tour yesterday. And what I'm going to cover, really, you got a chance to see in practice on the Dickinson College farm. Okay, so I'm going to start out with some general concepts and some ecological reasons why some of the things I'm going to talk about are supposed to work, and then end up with some information resources, because with insects, there are so many. You know, we don't have time to go over individual problems that you might see in your farms and gardens, but there are a lot of resources available to help you. Okay, so some goals for management. You know, we really want to manage a farm or a garden for productivity primarily, but we can also manage that for beneficial processes that are going to impact our productivity. And we should have a goal to improve the physical, chemical, and biological characteristics of our systems. And mainly this will come through improvement of soil, because when you improve the soil, you're going to improve plant health, and that's going to increase the tolerance and resistance of your plants to insects. And so another thing we want to do besides building up the health of our plants is to conserve all of those beneficial organisms that are going to help us control insects. Okay, so some principles, general principles. I know there's a tradition in conventional agriculture, we're going to look at a specific pest on a specific crop, and it's sort of not in context of the whole farming system. And I think it's really important because we're going to call on services from the landscape and the organisms in those landscapes to consider our cropping, our whole cropping system, all of the different crops in space and time as part of that larger environment. And Elliot Coleman has this concept of having practices that have a plant-positive effect rather than a pest-negative. A lot of times in pest management, we think of how are we going to kill that pest. But I think it's probably a better way to come to it is to think of how are we going to make this plant tolerant and resistant? How are we going to grow the most productive, healthy plant that's going to exist in this environment with both pests and beneficial organisms. It's also helpful to know, because there are going to be problems no matter how good we do at trying to manage this environment, it's still a disturbed environment, is we're going to have some decision-making criteria about are we going to take action or not action, and we'll talk a little bit about how we use these decision-making criteria in response to insect pests. And we want to know what all the tools are that are available to us to integrate them in a suitable manner and compatible. And even in organic systems where we try as much as possible to avoid the use of pesticides in a commercial farming system anyway, where your productivity and profitability are very much at stake, we may have to use some limited pesticides, but hopefully that's only as a very last resort after we've tried the integration, upfront integration of all these different ways to avoid pest problems. Okay, so some general tactics or sort of a how you want to approach this from the beginning. First of all, you really need to, for your system, you want to know what pests may occur for your particular crops, but not only the pests, but also the beneficials. And you want to be aware of those, how to identify those, and keep records. Maybe a certain kind of crop, squash. I always, have squash bugs. I'm just not going to grow it maybe in the future, or in a particular location or in a particular sequence. So there are lots of cultural and biological methods that we're also going to talk about. And in terms of biological control, my attitude is that we should conserve what's there. There are so many beneficial organisms in the environment. I really don't think we need to often buy them, except in special situations. It's better to manage to keep them in the system, to favor their existence in the system. And then there are sort of mechanical and physical methods of control that we'll talk about in this row cover, which is on the Dickinson farm, actually, from a couple summers ago, is an example of a physical barrier against pests and then allowable chemicals. So those are kind of our tactics that we have available to us. Sort of the theoretical background for how this all works, the soil food web, you're all familiar with that everybody, you can think of all of life, everybody eats something, right? And the base of this food web, of course, is plants who are making their own food from solar energy and nutrients from the soil. Then the organisms that feed plants, these arrows depict sort of the flow of energy. And we can also think about it sort of as a pyramid then, that here's the sun feeding energy into the plants, and this has been conceptualized. This is the producers at the bottom of the food chain. We move our way up through then the organisms that feed on plants, herbivores that are considered the primary consumers, then above them, carnivores, secondary consumers, and then we're at the top of the food chain, those top predators. And we can take advantage of those kind of relationships, and that's really the basis of biocontrol. So when we think about insects, so from the insect's point of view, a simple food chain, and factors that influence populations of insects, so we have this flea beetle here, a plant-feeding insect, and so below that, in that food pyramid or food chain, at the bottom are plants, so the insects are feeding on plants, but here at the top of the food chain, predator, in this case a spider. So when we think of control tactics, we can think about them as bottom up, things that affect the plant quality for insect food, and top down, sort of practices that impact those predators at the top of the food chain. And so what plays into plant quality for an insect? Well, the primary nutrients, the things everyone needs, the carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, nucleic acids, things that are nutrients for insects and why insects are eating plants and why we eat plants. But plants are defended. They have mechanical and structural plants. We can ask why the world is green. If, insects can eat all these plants, why is there any vegetation at all out there? And in general, in natural systems, you see there's insect damage on plants, but except in very rare cases do they totally wipe out all the vegetation. And that's because of these defenses, sort of waxes, little hairs on plants, structural lignins are structural sort of woody elements, but there are also plants are biochemically defended. And these can be constitutive as just the general makeup of plants, or they can be induced. And the induced is very interesting, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. So these biochemical defenses are termed secondary metabolites. They're not chemicals in plants that are used in this primary metabolism of making carbohydrates, lipids, proteins. But they're chemicals that we don't necessarily know all the functions of, but they're largely responsible, for example, for all the unique flavors of vegetables. Those are the chemicals that make broccoli taste different from corn. right? And they also have a lot of biological activities. A lot of our drugs are originally from plants, and the source of those are these secondary metabolites, alkaloids, cyanogenic glycosides and glucosinolates, terpenoids, and I know these are a lot of, you know, chemical names. So things like nicotine would be a plant secondary compound. So they have a lot of biological activity. Okay. So we'll talk a little bit about that as those chemicals as a bottom-up factor, and how different cultural practices might affect those plant secondary metabolites. But I think of cultural practices, anything that we do in the culture or the production of plants is our first way that we produce plants that are tolerant or resistant to, or make the plant less attractive to pests. First of all, you know, they're just pretty much common sense things. We are going to select a site and appropriate plant species and cultivars for that site. We're not going to try to grow oranges out or bananas out in the field in central Pennsylvania. You know, it's just inappropriate, not only with, you know. So we want to grow the most appropriate plant where it can grow fast and not be stressed. When possible, we want to grow insect and disease-free planting materials and resistant and tolerant planting materials. When you bring in material to your garden or farm, you want to make sure it's not already sickly looking and has insect pests on it. Appropriate planting date, again, especially where we're not going to be using pesticides. In commercial agriculture, conventional agriculture, a lot of seeds and plant material are protected with insecticides and fungicides, and so they can be planted in maybe less appropriate places at less appropriate times. But if we want to avoid using those things, we need to plant at an appropriate time when that plant is, when seed's going to germinate fast and get up fast and grow fast. Soil and fertility management. A lot of times we over-fertilize, and that makes the plant grow fast, but it also makes it very susceptible to plant damage. When it's too lush and it's got no toughness, right? It's sort of a wimpy plant growing fast to... Right, too lush, very attractive to an insect, a nice juicy plant. Over-fertilized, too much nitrogen in the leaf. The nitrogen is also very much a cue for insect feeding, excessive nitrogen in the tissue. We want some diversity, because, and the theoretical basis of that, and we saw that at the farm yesterday, incredible amount of diversity within beds and between beds, between natural habitat and cultivated habitat. Diversity, you can do that in a lot of ways. We saw that. And what there's a couple of theoretical reasons why that works. One of them has to do with plant appearance. When we have these huge monocultures, it's much easier for a pest insect to find like the big dinner plate full of food. And when the plant species are mixed up, you might... insects tend to be, there are some generalist insects, but many insects like a specific kind of plant in specific plant families. And so when those plant families are all mixed up, it makes it a little harder for the insects to find those particular crops that it likes. Also, diversity adds a lot of resources for beneficial organisms. And so you can build up your population of beneficials like that. And we saw that yesterday with the pollinator garden and the sort of permanent grassed strips as resources for beneficial organisms. And sanitation. If we have pest-infested, disease-infested material, we're not just going to leave it lay there. We're going to either till it in, take it away, burn it, compost it. Anyway, get it away from... the crop where we may have the problem. Okay, so I want to give some examples. I don't want to include lots of data in this talk. It's more conceptual, but to show you how some of these things work. This was from an experiment at the Rodale Institute in Pennsylvania. I don't know if you know it. They have the longest standing organic systems trial in the US. And what we're trying to do there, and also in some research that I'm involved with, is trying to reduce the amount of tillage we use for weed management in organic systems, because in organic systems we use a lot of tillage. So what we're doing is trying to manage the cover crops, in this case hairy vetch and rye, by rolling them with this roller crimper, and then planting no-till, planting our crops no-till into that. In this case, it's corn. There are certain pests, though, that really like that early season abundance of green residue, and the cutworms are one of those. And this is a black cutworm, and what it basically does is where there's a lot of residue, the moths come in, they lay their eggs on that residue, then here comes the roller and rolls down that residue, and makes a nice environment for the larvae. And if these large larvae are present, when there's a lot of residue in the susceptible stage of this little corn plant, you know, when it's just germinating, it's going to cut worms. That's what they do, is they just come in and cut off the plant. And so that drives down your plant population. And this shows the importance of planting date and knowing your system. So these are different dates when this cover crop was rolled and the corn was planted, and you can and this is the yield that we eventually get from the corn and the corn population. So where you have a low corn population, obviously you're going to have a low yield, and you can see the effect of date. And what's happening here is this is rolled and planted when these insects are in the environment, and they cut off a lot of those plants. But if you waited just another week or so, these larvae have already pupated and have flown off to other crops, and so your yield, your population and yield are much higher. We also lost a lot of yield because where you lose population, that leaves empty space for weeds to grow, and that makes, you know, what happens. Weeds are a major problem, especially in organic systems, and you don't want a lot of empty space for weeds to fill in. Okay, because that also impacts your yield. Okay, another way to use diversity and a cultural practice to affect the sort of appearance of plants to insects is called trap cropping. And this is where you plant a preferred crop around or in the same field as your sort of economic crop, your crop of interest. And the idea is that you are going to intercept pests. These are mobile pests as they move into a field. They're going to hit this trap crop border or strip before they get to your main crop that you're really more interested in. And this trap crop is going to sustain a lot of damage, but it's going to pull your pests away from that main crop. The thing is you're going to have to somehow treat the insects that are, you know, trapped in that trap crop, either through physical destruction. Sometimes the main crop is only susceptible. Plants are usually more susceptible when they're young, and so you may want to just protect this when it's young, and it doesn't matter if you destroy the trap crop once you've intercepted those pests, or you may have to apply an insecticide of some kind and keep this trap crop going if your main crop is susceptible throughout the season or attractive to pests throughout the season. Okay, so I talked about those plant chemicals and secondary metabolites and how they can be constitutive. They can be there all the time, or they can be induced by something in the environment. And this is a really interesting system, a bottom-up factor, because it affects, again, the plants, the bottom of the food chain. And it's these plant growth-promoting rhizobacteria. Rhizobacteria are bacteria that grow in the soil, and they're associated with plant roots. And when these bacteria are growing in association, they turn on the plant's immune system, right? They they turn on the production of these plant secondary metabolites, and that's called systemic acquired resistance, and it's called that because it's this association in the roots is turning on the immune system, and these chemicals are, plant chemicals are distributed throughout the whole plant. And so that's why it's systemic, because it's through the whole plant system and it's acquired or induced, because the plant has the ability to do that, but it really has to be turned on by something. And in this case, it's these bacteria that grow in the soil. An example of this, and Jeff Zender is here. I don't know if he's here. He's an entomologist. He's done a lot of work on this system. Is with cucurbits. Okay, so I don't know if you've grown cucurbits before, but they're very susceptible to cucumber beetles, both striped and spotted, and both as adults above ground and the root on the roots as larvae. And when, okay, so cucumbers produce a bitter compound called cucurbitacin. And have you ever tasted, you know, sliced into a cucumber and it has a bitter taste? No? You've never eaten a bitter cucumber? Yes. So that's what that chemical is right there. And that is actually a deterrent to some insects. It's a toxin to some insects. But cucumber beetles love that compound. That's how they cue in on the plant, is this bitter cucurbitacin. So when these plants are grown in soil with these plant growth promoting rhizobacteria, in this case, less cucurbitacin is produced, and it makes the plants less attractive to the beetles. And if you've grown cucumbers and you know about these beetles, you know they carry bacterial wilt, a disease of cucumbers. And where these bacteria have resulted in reduced cucurbitacin, we have less cucumber beetle feeding and also less bacterial wilt because the beetles are carrying the bacteria, and less feeding means that less bacteria are being transmitted to the plants. So that's an interesting, I think, effect of sort of management on plant quality for these pests. Another interesting place where we can affect the plant quality for pests is the sort of soil fertility practices that we use. This is from really recent research in Britain, actually, and they were comparing the effects of using manure-based fertilizers and synthetic fertilizers on cabbage insect pest, and they controlled the amount of fertility, the amount of nitrogen that they were supplying. So they were applying poultry manure to supply the same amount of nitrogen as their synthetic fertilizer. And then they looked at a suite of pests on cabbage. And so, as I mentioned before, some types of pests really are specialists on a specific kind or family of plants, whereas other plant-feeding insects are more generalists and can feed across a wide range of pests. And the examples here are cabbage aphids, which are specialists on cabbages. Green peach aphids are very general. They can attack a lot of different kinds of pests. And then a diamondback moth is also a specialist on plants in the cabbage family. And what these researchers found was that where synthetic fertilizer was used, there were more abundance of the generalist pest and also a preference for egg laying by this moth when compared with plants that had been fertilized with manure. However, where they fertilized with manure, they had more abundance of the specialist insect. And what they found, how the different type of fertilizer affected the plants, was that the nitrogen concentration was greater where they used a synthetic fertilizer. And so we know that soluble nitrogen in leaves can increase insect pressure. But also this secondary plant metabolite, the glucosinolate, that's sort of the chemical that makes that broccoli or cabbagey taste in plants were up to 3 times greater in the cabbage plants grown with manure. And so it was a very complex reaction. It was different for specialists and generalist insects, but it did show how we fertilize plants can really affect what pests. So if you know that you have some of these more generalist pests, or if you know you have a problem with diamondback moth, you may consider what type of fertility you use. And I know in organic systems, of course, we don't even use synthetic fertilizers, and that may help explain why in the organic systems I've worked in anyway, we just don't have the same level of pests as we do in some of the conventional systems. Okay, so those are some examples of bottom-up factors, how we can affect the plant as a food plant for the food item for an insect. And now there are those top-down. If we remember the food chain, predators are at the top of the food chain. And so those natural enemies include predators, and those, we like predators. I know these aren't as cute as baby pigs as we saw in the last presentation, but I don't know. That one's kind of cute. Predators, we like generalist predators because they consume many, many insects during their lifetime, and we really want to try to manage for these generalist predators, right? Mites, predatory bugs, spiders, ground beetles, daddy long legs, centipedes. Parasitoids are these very small wasps, and you can purchase parasitoids, but there are so many kinds of parasitoids in the environment. And yesterday we saw that pollinator garden with a lot of flowering plants. These parasitoids need resources like pollen and nectar. Also, the adults do, because it's the immature form. This is a little wasp laying its egg in egg. It's the immature form that is the natural enemy, in this case, the direct natural enemy of the insect. And so we have parasitoids that include wasps, and also some flies are also parasitoids.